Well, I usually, when I'm asked to comment, or in this case, when I ask myself to comment on more than one paper, I like having some kind of unified story to tell, a thread to weave through the three papers that could sort of be an organizing principle for questions addressed to each speaker. And I won't do that this time because I just can't see the thread. And so I'll basically ask one question to each speaker as a way of kicking off the discussion, and I will do that in the order that the presentations were given, starting with Peter. So I take it that there are two moods, I think, in that two rhetorical sort of constellations in which talk of neutrality tends to occur, and those two rhetorical moods or constellations are present in your paper. One is what I would call a kind of defensive posture. We know that the state has to act, and we would really rather that it did so as little as possible. And so we define a whole area of rights, liberties, where we can do whatever the hell we want, with respect to religion, with respect to sex, with respect to all sorts of things, and say, look, state, stay out of there. And to the extent that you do, you will be acting, amongst other things, neutrally, right? And then there's a more positive mood, which I think a lot of liberal political theorists who are less sort of skeptical and negative about the role of the state tend to employ, which is that the state must act, and of course it must act, but when it does so, it owes its citizenry a certain kind of justification, and that sort of justification is one that is neutral, one that, well, and whatever that means. And so I guess the my observation is that it's not given a priori that what neutrality will mean when one is speaking in the first mood, right, whatever is left over for the state to do once we have protected basic rights and liberties, right, that the conception of neutrality that we have in mind there will be the same as the one that we have in mind when we are asking what are the ways in which the state should address itself to its citizens when justifying state action, particular course of state action. Now, I guess my question to you is, so there's another question which has to do with the independence or not of those two questions, because one could, after all, say, starting with the priority of the affirmative or the second question, well, we will define what neutral reasons are, what acceptable reasons are upon which we can act. Whatever is left over for the discretion of citizens will be what the state can not act on if it is to cleave to the requirement of neutrality. Or you could go the other way, right? You could decide that the first question is sort of the primary, fundamental one in the order of justification, and define what the acceptable reasons for the state are just by exclusion, whatever prevents it from acting in these areas. So I guess I have two questions. And both these moods are present in the paper. If I take you, I hope everyone has printed it out in the same font and has the same format. But on page 8, something like the more positive, affirmative story is referred to. When you give the reasons that can justify the government in limiting an important liberty only if it meets three conditions, one of which is the sufficient epistemic reason to accept the proposition that constitutes a personal reason or set of reasons. That sounds like it's sort of treading into the territory that people like Nagel have sort of developed to some degree. Well, what is the position, epistemic position, that one needs to occupy in order to look upon the policy sort of arena in a neutral way and in a way that won't encroach on people's positive conceptions of the good? And here in principle, it sounds like there could be, although Nagel famously has sort of drifted from one answer to another, there could be a kind of unified answer to this question. There's no reason in principle to think that we can't come up with some kind of an epistemic story that that makes good the requirement that's spelled out in 2 there on page 5 in your paper. The more kind of eliminativist story that you're telling, which towards the conclusion of the paper, sounds like it is prioritizing the other story, the defensive story. There's all these things that are terribly important in the lives of individuals, freedom of religion, freedom to organize themselves sexually according to their convictions as they wish, and we really want the state to stay out of that. Now, there's no reason to think that that constitutes anything like a unified whole, that those different liberties and freedoms constitute a unified whole. So I guess my double-barreled question to you is, first of all, which of the two stories do you see as most important to answer first? Do you see them as dependent? And to the extent that they are dependent, is there one that should drive our answer to the second? And I guess to some degree, to what extent is your final kind of skeptical-ish answer to the question about neutrality dependent upon tacitly presupposing that the sort of defensive answer, the answer that says we have to defend all of these individual liberties, whatever's left over is going to be called neutral, is sort of the priority one? Is that something that you'd want to affirm? I hope that that's fairly clear. Jacob, the problem with Jacob's paper is I agree just about with every single word of it, and so it's very hard for me to formulate a critical question. I guess I'll play sort of devil's, maybe not devil's advocate, but little, what are the?
Imps
advocate. And say, well, maybe there's a different case that can be, try this case on for the sustainability liberal. So there's no incontrovertible causal story that has been told either by Galston or by Macedo or by any other of the people that have been drawn towards the sort of sustainability argument against neutrality to say that we need these state actions in order for whatever virtues individuals have to have for the whole system to stay afloat. We don't need state action. There's no causal story that's been told plausibly to make that story good. On the other hand, most liberal societies already have these practices in place. Schools will teach kids about civic responsibility. There's all kinds of things out there that amount to practices through which the state non-neutrally favors the virtues it feels it needs in order to keep the whole thing afloat. Now, so there's kind of like, you can think there's two things that are contributing to keeping the thing afloat. There are things that would be contributing to keeping it afloat anyway, which you very ably sort of described. And then there are the things that we contribute through deliberate state action, through the schools, through patriotism enhancing actions, the whole range of things that states do to promote the requisite virtues, the requisite. Now, we don't know that if we were to pull the second one away, the whole thing would crumble. But could we think of the sustainability argument in terms of kind of a liberal precautionary principle? Right? Let's not wait for all the evidence to come in before we put up extra. It could be that we're overkill, that we're engaging in overkill. But overkill is better than underkill. If there's one pillar up there that's actually not sustaining any weight, all it is a useless pillar. Whereas it would be terrible to find out that if we took it away, the whole thing would. So it sounds like what we need in order to go the anti-sustainability route is something stronger than what you've shown. We need to be able to show not only that, there's no causal story that has plausibly been told to show that it's necessary. We need something stronger, namely, it's actually doing harm. It's counterproductive. It's actually, rather than being an extra pillar, it's actually eroding the pillars that are already there. And then we would have an argument for saying, look, state, stay out of these sort of liberal perfectionism areas. Now, I happen to think, actually, that such a story might be tellable, but I was wondering what your views were on that issue. Okay, and now over to Ruben. So your basic case, as far as I can tell, in this very rich paper that has a lot of different directions in it, is that the harm prevent principle provides us with a pretty good reason to affirm state neutrality, even with respect to the non-controversial conceptions of the good, to the extent that such things exist. Now, I guess I want to. Maybe this, is, at the end of the day, is a way to ask you to flesh out what I think is actually some pretty rich and important territory that occurs in between the RAS story, which says that essentially we know that there are fulfillment-promoting or flourishing-promoting and non-flourishing, there are good and bad ways of life, and we prevent people from harming themselves. It's just a good thing to prevent people from engaging in bad ways of life, right? So that's one extreme. Your sort of more minimalist reading is another. But how about cases like this? So, and these are just, you probably know where I'm going from discussions that we've had in the past. There are a lot of things that people want, and they don't self-deludedly, it's not a self-delusion that they want them. They actually want to stop smoking, lose weight, on and on. But they're slightly weak-willed, and I use that expression without just waving at all of the philosophical difficulties that the notion of weakness of the will introduces, but let's take it as read for the time being. And the state helps them doing what they want by, for example, preventing them from being able to smoke pretty much anywhere, actually, if you're living here. Or by making certain kinds of food more difficult to access. So on the one hand, you have some perfectionism here. You have, you know, the state acting in areas where a more sort of minimalist conception of the Hardin principle would say, don't go there. But it seems that you're doing it in virtue of something that people are actually would be inclined to affirm. And another type of case is, you know, and this goes back to the famous paper by Dworkin to do with arts funding, right? So the market will tend to make it very difficult, you know, will make it tend, being very, very sort of brisk about it, will make it fairly easy for people to access Britney Spears, but more difficult for them to access Benjamin Britten. Now, we don't know actually whether people prefer Britney Spears or Benjamin Britten in a context where those two were on equal offer, right? You get exposed to a lot more Britney Spears than you do to Benjamin Britten, right? And so making it easier for people, for example, through funding of the arts, which will make an opera ticket cost, say, $20 rather than $200, or funding a public radio where what is presented on the radio is not dictated by the market, but rather by some kind of perfectionist sense of art, is a way for us to find out, actually, to put Benjamin Britten and Britney Spears. There was some kind of vague alliterative intent in those two. To put Benjamin Britten and Britney Spears on an equal footing in order to find out, you know, what it is that people actually want. So, you know, I could go on, but there are cases like that where perfectionism of a certain kind seems to be not excessively troubled by your argument, because it doesn't seem to run up against what I take to be sort of plausibly construed conception of the Hardin principle. Okay, I'll stop there. So we're about 10 minutes behind schedule, which for a philosophy conference is like being ahead of time. And so I'm going to declare that we have about 45 minutes for discussion. Now, perhaps I could just, in order to get people literally and figuratively warmed up, ask each speaker to the extent that they want to maybe just say a word about the commentator, me. We forgot to name chairs, so the chair and the commentator have to be the same person. But we could also just go to the room, so I don't know how people...
I'd like to say something briefly in response
okay.
to
that.
I believe that it is a central issue in political philosophy to identify the sorts of reasons that can justify the government in limiting individual liberty. I take that to be a central philosophical question. Now, one possible response is the anarchist response. No reasons can justify the government in limiting individual liberty. I assume that that's false and that most of us agree with that. Another possibility is that no reasons can justify the government in limiting a certain set of liberties, basic liberties, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and so forth. That also seems to be too extreme. There are people who are First Amendment absolutists, but on reflection, it seems that there are some reasons that can justify the government in limiting freedom of speech, freedom of religion, at least under some circumstance. I mean, in freedom of religion to prevent human sacrifice, for example, freedom of speech, divulging of military secrets, and so forth. It seems that there are some reasons that can justify the government in limiting those liberties. So we have a theoretical project of trying to distinguish in a general way, what sorts of reasons can justify the government in limiting important liberties, what sorts of reasons cannot. One proposal along these lines is Mill's famous proposal, which Ruvon pursues. Now, I see the principle of neutrality as a successor to Mill's harm principle in a way that I suggested in my paper. I think that the reason why philosophers like Ronald Dworkin and Bruce Ackerman and others were attracted to the principle of neutrality is it seemed to them to capture what was right about Mill's harm principle, the anti-moralistic implications, without committing them to the full anti-paternalism. I think both Hart and Dworkin and many others have had doubts that paternalism is always wrong. But they thought there was still something right, that Mill was onto something right, and they're trying to capture what that was. So I see the primary function of the principle of neutrality originally proposed by Dworkin as, I suppose, a defensive principle. It's a principle that's supposed to rule out certain reasons as adequate justifications for the government to restrict certain important liberties. As I indicated, I don't think theoretically it's a very helpful principle because we don't have a clear notion of the distinction between neutral and non-neutral reasons. But I think it's important to understand the original impetus behind the principle of neutrality, see it as a principle of liberty that was trying to occupy roughly the same space as Mill's harm principle.
Daniel asked me more or less whether it might not be the case that liberal institutional orders have depended implicitly on a level of non-neutral activity that is going on all the time. And part of my response to that will be, again, to point to the robustness of liberal institutions to significant changes in the moral dispositions of their citizenry. That is, stuff changes over time. One generation doesn't look morally very much like its predecessor. And the mechanism for the overprotection theory would have to be that the overprotection has kept some substantial quantity of the stuff in the citizenry to begin with, and that the institutions have been dependent on that stability. And I would again point to the instability. Daniel suggested, well, mightn't it be something like a precautionary principle? Maybe that pillar is not bearing any weight, but maybe it is better not to take it away and find out. I'm fully persuaded that there is in most domains of the world no such thing as the precautionary principle. Because overcorrection on one dimension involves some kind of cost that you're incurring on some other dimension. And you cannot systematically overprotect across everything. Say that it's the case that liberal orders are fragile and that they depend on a certain quantity of free thinkingness in their citizenry and that they depend on a certain quantity of respect for authority and law-abidingness among their citizenry. There's no such thing as the precautionary principle in those circumstances. If you overprotect your education for open-mindedness, you are going to underprotect your education for respect for authority, and vice versa. In this kind of domain, if you set out as your goal, well, let's go too far just to be safe, the likelihood that you're too far incurs some other costs that might undermine the project on some other dimension seems to be very high. Finally, Daniel suggested something that I fully agree with but was trying not to commit to in these remarks. Might it be the case that the perfectionist state action not only isn't a harmless pillar but actively undermines the provision by more spontaneous social institutions of the underlying virtues? I certainly think that is often the case. Now, how often depends on exactly what the perfectionist policies are, and I often find it very hard to get a grip on whether in the debates about neutrality and perfection, we're debating criminal prohibitions, we're debating civic education, we're debating public service announcements on television, or quite what. A lot of the time, as this stuff penetrates into the political sphere, it seems to be at the level public service announcements and exhortations. That stuff, it's pretty clear to me, does something vanishingly close to no good at all, and likely does harm by means of trivialization. And I think that the American experience with anti-drug exhortations has been exemplary evidence of this, from Reefer Madness in the 30s to Just Say No and This Is Your Brain on Drugs in the 80s. Every generation discovers that their first marijuana cigarette does not seem to instantly addict them to crack and does not seem to instantly turn them into raving rapists. And then they come to disbelieve the whole system of lessons that they are being exhorted to on television. To the degree that what we're looking at is civic education, well, then it depends. I do think that formal civics classes in high schools very often have the same kind of trivializing character. They actively undermine the cultivation of the virtues because they make the whole thing look relatively silly. But there is a great deal of civic pedagogy that runs throughout a curriculum that I don't have that same kind of confidence about, and that could conceivably be doing that maybe harmless and maybe unnoticed load-bearing work. I just wouldn't want to jump to the conclusion very quickly that it was doing load-bearing work.
Well, just a few words. I think I'm making it all so short. I'm making it that it is so short because I'm like speaking less than I thought. No?
You're fine.
No,
everybody's
okay. Well, so, well, it's interesting to notice that in France, for example, if smoking has been prohibited, it was not out of like the welfare of the smoker, but it was because it would harm other people. So I don't think that it's a good example. And second, as for Britain and Spears, even in this case, I'm not sure that we couldn't find a better justification for state subsidizing of Britain than the fact that Britain's peace is not as good as Britain. I'm sure that we could find other arguments which would be better.
Thank you.